And I do apologize to committee members who are here on time for our starting a little late this afternoon. I'm called to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Public Safety Subcommittee, a public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, the Oregon Youth Authority. And I'd like to call forward Mr. Bob Jester, and who will be joining you for this first segment?
Mr. Lemon.
And Phil Lemon. And colleagues and members of the audience, just so that I can explain for the record how we will beginning, how we will be beginning our time with the Oregon Youth Authority. Of course, we are here to hear a budget overview and presentation from the agency, but it has also come to light recently that there are some serious concerns and allegations regarding a, I believe, former employee of the agency, the Oregon Youth Authority, a probation officer, and allegations involving young men in his charge. Senator Winters, before she took time off to have her surgery, and let me say as an aside, we understand that Senator Winters is doing very well, good. Released from the hospital today.
Good.
Definitely good news. But Senator Winters came to me before she took the time off and indicated that she would be drafting a letter to the chair expressing her concerns after reading an Oregonian article related to the Oregon Youth Authority. And I shared with Senator Winters that I would, in fact, read the letter for the record. The letter was also shared with the agency last week, so they've had the opportunity to not only review the letter, but to review the questions that Senator Winters poses in her letter, which is dated March 17th. And members, you have a copy of that letter in front of you. Senator Winters wrote, "Dear Senator Gordley, I am certain I join many others in my complete shock at reading the Oregonian article regarding the suicide of Aaron Munoz and the allegations that Michael Lee Boyles, his probation officer, sexually abused Aaron and many young men in his caseload. As you know, I will not be present in Public Safety Subcommittee when the Oregon Youth Authority budget comes before you. In light of that, I would like to share my feelings and request that several questions be asked of the Oregon Youth Authority by you and other members of the subcommittee. I will be looking closely at this issue and the response by OYA when I return to my legislative duties. First of all, I fervently and passionately believe the physical, sexual, and emotional abuse of our most vulnerable population must be stopped. This is especially true of our children. Children in foster care or the juvenile system are thought by some to be rejects, no good, and a throwaway commodity. This is absolutely false and should be profoundly stated as false. The status quo in dealing with these types of abuse allegations is totally unacceptable and has gone on far too long in our society. To read in the Oregonian of the grooming of children for sexual gratification by an adult in authority, whether parent, teacher, minister, foster care provider, or adult supervisor, is abhorrent. The fact that Mr. Boyles over the last 10 years was the subject of numerous complaints and grievances by families of youngsters in the care of the Juvenile Probation and Parole Division, later to become the Oregon Youth Authority with no substantive action taken, must be addressed now. I would like the following questions answered by the Oregon Youth Authority and or any other person agency, or department as it pertains to this particular case. After the death of Aaron Munoz, allegations of repeated abuse by Michael Boyle surfaced, covering over a 10-year period. Question one. State officials received repeated and detailed warning and allegations from family members. Who specifically received the warnings, and why weren't they taken seriously? Question two. The Juvenile Probation and Parole Division of the Department of Human Services, predecessor to the Oregon Youth Authority, failed to report suspected sexual abuse to police as required by law. Why? Question three. Why was Mr. Boyles allowed to continue his supervision of children for an additional 8 years, during which time he allegedly molested other young boys? Question four. Was Mr. Jim Lyman properly evaluated and screened for a foster home? Question five. Were follow-up unannounced visits conducted by the Department of Human Services at Mr. Lyman's home after allegations of child pornography were made? Question six. After a police investigation, why did Mr. Boyles remain on the payroll but cautioned to stay away from children from 2002 until his arrest in 2004, 2 years later? Question seven, what course of action was taken when Mr. Boyle's supervisor told police detectives about his preference for clean-cut 13 to 17-year-old boys? Question eight, how could Ms. Karen Brazeau, director of the Oregon Youth Authority from 2000 to 2004, allege to not know details of this case until 2002, at which time foster parents brought issues of Mr. Boyle's inappropriate behavior to light? Question nine, what is the procedure of transferring a youth from one facility to another over the objections of family? Question 10, what is the guideline for state-supervised children spending extended periods of time with their probation officer, including overnight stays? Question 11, what is the procedure by the state when letters are received from family or perhaps an attorney representing the family of a youth in state custody when abuse is strongly suspected? Question 12, by what rule or statute can the family of a youth in state custody be denied any contact? In summary, how can abuse go on for so many years when red flags were raised by families, friends, caseworkers, supervisors of caseworkers, and management? Chair Gordley, I respectfully request that this issue be thoroughly reviewed. Action by either administrative rule or legislation may be necessary to reduce any opportunity for abuse by an adult toward a young person in state care. Stricter rules and guidelines must be in place to prevent another child from this devastation and life-altering experience, such as the cases mentioned in the newspaper article. When red flags of abuse or neglect are raised by anyone at any time, management must pay attention and not sweep the issue under the carpet to keep the status quo. Thank you for taking time to listen to my request. I look forward to the response from the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Youth Authority when I return to my legislative duties. Sincerely, Jackie Winters, Oregon State Senator, District 10. Again, as I stated before reading the letter has been provided to the agency, and you've had an opportunity to look at how you wish to respond, and you have that opportunity now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I am the Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. I appreciate the opportunity given to me by Senator Gordley to use some of the time in this budget hearing to address questions raised by the Oregonian's recent story regarding alleged sex abuse of a youth in state care by a juvenile probation officer and a foster parent. I realize that this is a budget hearing and that you might have more questions than we have time for today. I want you to know that I and the Youth Authority will respond to the best of our ability both today and in the future. I would like to make three brief points before presenting specific information about this case and responding to the questions posed by Senator Winters. First, I want you to know that I regret that the actions taken by the Oregon Youth Authority were not sufficient to protect the victims from harm it appears they have suffered. I have spent my entire professional career in Oregon's Juvenile Corrections Agency and do not have the words to tell you how troubled I am that an alleged pedophile apparently was able to use his position of public trust and authority in this agency to sexually abuse vulnerable youth under his charge. Second, I am convening a group of youth advocates and justice professionals to thoroughly and independently review this case and the actions that the Youth Authority has already taken to address the questions and concerns involved. This group will be given every available access to information that they need to assess the actions we have taken and report what additional actions should be taken to ensure the safety of the youth in our custody. I will ask them to complete their review within 60 days, but will continue their authority if additional time is needed. You will receive the committee's report directly and agency reports on how we will implement those recommendations. Finally, I want you to know that despite the apparent actions of one former OYA employee and one former foster parent, that the 1,100 people who work at the Youth Authority are strongly committed to protecting public safety, protecting the youth in our custody, and to provide meaningful reformation opportunities. We realize that despite our many accomplishments and the pride that we have in our work, the tragic results of this case have diminished the trust and confidence in the Oregon Youth Authority, and we will work ceaselessly to restore that confidence. I would now like to address the specific questions raised by Senator Winters. In your packets, you have the 12 questions that Senator Winters presented and our written answers to those questions. I would like to preface going through those by saying that this is the information we have to date. We continue in pursuit of additional information. All of the documents that have been cited by the Oregonian are not in the agency's possession, and so some of those we cannot respond to. Additionally, in your packet, you have a timeline of events document starting from the point in which Mr. Boyles was hired through June 27th. Of 05 when the criminal trial is scheduled to begin. We have included the overview of agency actions regarding the Michael Boyles related case, which was prepared on March 8, 2005, which addresses staff conduct, staff management of youth, and foster home management. We have included, for your reference, the juvenile code on 419B005, reporting of child abuse statute. We have included a letter that was cited in the Oregonian article by a Mrs. Howland, and a response to Mrs. Howland's letter by Rick Hill, then Assistant Administrator for the Office of Juvenile Corrections. This is one document that we have been able to locate. We have included Division 430 of the Oregon Youth Authority OARs, which addresses visitor policy and rules. We have included our policy on staff relationship with offenders, and I think that's it. I think that's what we've included.
Mr. Jester, if you would proceed and just walk us through the responses to each of the questions. We do need to create a record of your responses.
Absolutely. And I will ask Deputy Director Phil Lemon to step in and provide any further detail or help me if I misstate something. Question one had to do with the state officials receiving repeated and detailed warnings and allegations from family members. Who specifically received the warnings and why weren't they taken seriously? Our reply, OAA can verify two such contacts with State's Juvenile Corrections Agency, either Children's Services Division or Oregon Youth Authority, between the dates of 1994 and the year 2002. We will continue to look for, review, and investigate any additional contacts or documents that we have. The contacts we can currently verify are a November 1994 letter from Margaret Howland's attorney to a supervisor at CST. The letter sought additional funding from Ms. Howland's grandson. Residential placement was assigned to an assistant administrator at the Children's Service Division for response. All available information on this contact is based on entries in a CSD database, but we do not have copies of the correspondence. It is only the entry of a letter coming in, the purpose of the letter, and who it was assigned to for a reply. An April 1995 letter from Ms. Howland to CSD administrator. Information on Ms. Howland's correspondence is based on a CSD database entry, which notes Ms. Howland's concern for her grandson is not getting appropriate treatment and cites nonspecific concerns about the grandson's caseworker and a foster parent. OIA does not have a copy of the original letter. The letter was responded to on April 21st, 1995, in a letter from a CSD assistant administrator. Number two, the Juvenile Probation and Parole Division of DHS, predecessor of the Oregon Youth Authority, failed to report suspected child abuse to police as required by law. Why? The Department of Human Services is researching archive records to determine whether CSD referred any reports to law enforcement. The Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and Oregon State Police investigators have told the Oregon Youth Authority they have found no violation of mandatory reporting laws in their investigation and review of this case. OIA Director Robert Jester has ordered that all OIA employees receive additional training in their responsibilities in complying with mandatory reporting law, and they will receive that training within the next 60 days, and that mandatory reporting duties be included in annual refresher training for all employees. OIA recognizes that action may be needed even if information does not reach the level of filing a mandatory report. We will work on training staff to address those issues and concerns. Question three, why was Mr. Bowles allowed to continue his supervision of children for an additional 8 years, during which time he alleged molested other young boys? This is the heart of the matter at hand and one that OIA cannot fully answer at this time. Despite information available to OIA, we did not connect the information we received adequately. OIA Director Robert Jester is convening an independent review panel of justice professionals and advocates for youth to review information from this case and make recommendations regarding additional changes OIA needs to make to ensure protection of youth and its custody. Question four. Was Jim Lyman properly evaluated and screened as a foster parent? It appears that Mr. Lyman was properly screened and met all requirements in place at the time for initial provisional certification in the year 1994. However, entries in the foster home certification file indicate concerns that warranted additional follow-up. These concerns include: on April 21st, 1994, letter to Mr. Lyman expressing concern about his belief regarding age of consent for minors to engage in sexual activity with adults. This concern was also noted in an August 1994 foster home study. A February 8, 1995, Foster Home Recertification Study refers to sexually oriented art in the home that would be, quote, inappropriate in any foster home, end quote. The file does not contain record of specific follow-up action. In March of 1996, a youth filed an allegation of physical abuse in the home. The report was filed with CSD, which referred to OIA for action. There is no action reflected in the file. OIA is reviewing whether any action was taken and just not reflected in the file. A January 1997 foster home recertification study refers to an allegation of Lyman, quote, throwing youth against wall, end quote. The issue was reviewed by the foster home certifier. OIA is reviewing this, whether the report should have been referred to CSD as report of suspected abuse. An intake report by CSD Child Protective Services in July 1998 contains allegation by a youth that he was allowed to smoke marijuana and drink beer while on a trip to Mexico with foster parent Lyman. The incident was reviewed and resolved without further action after Mr. Lyman stated that he found the youth possessing marijuana, threw it in the fire, and referred the youth to a treatment program.
Excuse me.
Representative Hansen.
Was there follow-up in terms of the referral to the youth treatment program? Was that verified or is that unverified?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have specific information in front of me, but I will get that for you. In August 1998, a youth in OIA Correctional Facility reported that foster parent Lyman had observed him getting out of the shower and made sexual comments, and that there was, quote, demented artwork in the home. During an additional review by OIA, the youth was unable to recall any specific information about this incident. The matter was referred to the foster home certifier. The file contains no entry of follow-up action.
The matter was reported to the Oregon State Police, which declined to investigate. It was omitted.
Madam Chair, yes. I'm sorry, I missed that sentence. Question five, were follow-up unannounced visit?
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's your protocol going to be for this? Shall we hold questions until we've completed the review?
I would encourage you to ask questions as we go through.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question?
Certainly.
This item four is a tough one. And the answers are, I suppose the answers and true, but to go from 94 to 98 with the type of incidents reported and apparently very little to no action being taken is troubling. Extremely so. And I think you're doing the right thing and coming up with whatever answer is there. But to this committee, how do you keep this from happening? And how would this be different today? How would we be assured that it would be different today?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I think that you also get the heart of the issue and the fact that it is difficult for this committee to hear the sequence of these events. It is equally as painful for the Youth Authority and its workers to experience this as well. We have done a number of things which is included in the handout from March 8, 2005, specifically to address this issue of reducing the propensity for there to be any kind of abuse either in a foster home or any other placement with a youth offender without those dots being connected by supervisors and administration. And there is more work to be done in this area. I believe that we have made a start. One of the things that we have realized is that the foster home certification and the case management function report to one supervisor, and that reports up to one assistant administrator. It's rather linear. There's not an inherent check and balance.
and not as an excuse, but as a reality. Some of these youth are extremely difficult to place, and the recruitment of foster parents is also difficult, and there is a constant balance between getting appropriate placements for these youth where they will be safe and public safety issues will be addressed, and also that there is, in fact, a place to put them. And not that we in any way encourage or want less than adequate placements for youth out there.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
And keeping in mind, we just received this material today, so haven't had time to review. And if it's the answers are here, we can get to them. But as an example of the sexually oriented art in a home that would be inappropriate in a foster care, if that report came in today, I mean, it seems common sense in my mind, you'd take everybody out of that home. But what would happen? What's the reality today?
Madam Chair, Representative Hann, I think you're absolutely right that I believe the Youth Authority has learned from this experience, and we absolutely would pull the youth out of any placement that we felt did not adequately address their safety. And if there were any concerns that were not adequately resolved in that home, we would take those very seriously. The lack of documentation in the foster home certification file around what actions may have been taken addressing the artwork in this home, because they are not there, I can't definitively state to you what was or was not done. If the artwork was removed, if there was some reasonable explanation of same, I don't know.
Follow up one more time. I mean, it might indicate when you go from
CSD
April of 94 to August of 98 that, again, a youth reported that the artwork in the home was demented. I might answer your question. It probably wasn't removed, or if it was, it went right back up. So it looks like it. I mean, one might surmise that nothing happened on that.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you. Mr. Jester, obviously the entire committee shares your concern about the record in both of these cases, one being the record of the employee and the other being the record of the foster parent. And to all of us, I mean, what's in front of us is new. Plus, I mean, all that we know is, I hate to use this terminology, is what we've read recently in the newspapers. So that's the depth of my knowledge on this particular issue, which is kind of limited. But asking that issue about what would happen today, I'm just trying to clarify this in my mind. A foster parent who would be under the control, or not control, but regulation, probably the Department of Human Services, who had an OYA client in that facility, what would the channels be for somebody maybe inspecting that foster home, for the information actually getting to OYA or getting to simultaneously to appropriate authorities within DHS? And at what point would you refer it on to, who would you refer it on to for investigation, and who takes responsibility for investigation?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I think you have several questions in there. Let me first clarify that at the point in time which the juvenile corrections programs were separated from the administrative oversight of the Children's Service Division, and for a six-month period of time, juvenile corrections was a standalone agency within the Department of Human Services, and then split off to become the Oregon Youth Authority in July of 1996. At that time, we brought with us the foster home certifiers, the workers, and the supervisors that were providing that probation pre-youth correctional facility commitment. So those homes are ours. We are responsible for those homes. There is not a shared responsibility for certification. There is not a shared accountability with DHS. That lies with the Oregon Youth Authority. So that mistakes that were made in the oversight of this home are those solely the Youth Authority and not DHS's, to clarify that.
What is the, Madam Chair, what is the current status in terms of if a complaint was received? Would they
The current status is that we have certifiers whose responsibility is to certify and monitor foster homes.
Now, close. Are those within DHS or within OYA?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, those are within the Oregon Youth Authority.
Okay.
The certifier who is responsible for the certification and the ongoing oversight of the foster home enters into a file now into JGIS. Information regarding that home reports to a supervisor, and that supervisor would be reporting to an assistant administrator at the Oregon Youth Authority with any concerns or complaints about that home.
Please continue. Do we know? Let me ask this one question. Do you know why the Oregon State Police declined to investigate? Is that documented?
Madam Chair, there's not specific information in the file, but in thinking about this, and I would be interested in Representative Hanna's take on this as well. I believe that because this behavior would not result in a law violation, that it was more of an internal policy issue, that the Oregon State Police would have said, this is something you need to look at, would not be something we would look at. But that's my best guess.
It's a guess, but not based on any documentation in the records that reveals why they declined.
Madam Chair, if I may, Phil Lemon, Deputy Director for the Youth Authority. I have not reviewed what specific information the youth reported to the Youth Authority that was referred to the State Police. One of the consistent themes throughout this matter, however, is whether the information was specific enough and detailed enough that it says, this happened to me on this date, it would constitute a criminal violation if it was true, and that's kind of the information that's needed to support an allegation to move it forward, especially in the criminal context. In the first Oregon State Police investigation that occurred in November of 2002, that came back with inconclusive evidence that would not support a formal criminal charge. And so that has been an issue throughout this case, and we will be reviewing not only those instances where the information does support a mandatory child abuse report, but also that raises concerns but doesn't rise to that legal threshold.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Please continue.
Question number five, were there follow-up unannounced visits conducted by DHS at Lyman's home after allegations of child pornography were made? Again, the foster home file does not contain documentation of unannounced visits to the Lyman foster home. Current OYA practice requires both scheduled and unscheduled visits to homes on a monthly basis. Six.
Representative Hansen.
How long has that OYA practice been in place?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I couldn't tell you definitively, but we'll get that answer to you.
Okay.
How long
is that? I would like very much to know that. Basically, what I know is, or what I'm interested in, was that their practice during the times of the abuse, or is it something that you put in as a remedial action recently?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, this was a practice that we put in place upon review of this case and some other matters involving foster care in the state.
Okay.
The notion of unannounced, unscheduled visits to foster homes.
Okay, that's all I
need. Question six, after police investigation, why did Mr. Bowles remain on the payroll but cautioned to stay away from children from 2002 until his arrest in 2004, 2 years later? The Oregon Youth Authority terminated Mr. Bowles' state employment when it had sufficient evidence and had completed the process required by the collective bargaining agreement. Briefly, OYA placed Boyles on leave but deferred additional action until the initial Oregon State Police investigation was completed. OYA then conducted an internal review which led to Mr. Boyles' dismissal. The attached chronology identifies the significant dates in this sequence. Mr. Broyles was placed on administrative leave in November of 2002. You may recall this is when then-Director Brazero received information from a foster parent that rose to the level of concern about the potential of criminal misconduct on the part of the foster parent. The Oregon State Police were immediately notified of that complaint, and Mr. Broyles was placed on administrative leave. That police investigation concluded in January of 2003 and found that there was inconclusive information or evidence to proceed with any kind of charges, at which time the Oregon Youth Authority began an internal investigation based on some of the information that had been contained in that police report. We did not do a parallel investigation from November of 2002, but we waited to the conclusion of the Oregon State Police investigation and then took their findings and proceeded. Mr. Broyles was on leave. When he returned from leave, he was placed in a different position and capacity with the Youth Authority that did not allow him contact with youth, but was a desk job in another office in another county doing another function while we completed our investigation. Mr. Broyles was arrested in January of 2004, and simultaneous to that, in January of 2004, our internal investigation had concluded, and we moved for dismissal of Mr. Broyles. As that was moving forward, he was arrested. In that time, one of the previously interviewed victims stepped forward and said, you know, I want to talk. I want to disclose these behaviors. I was not willing to do that before. I am willing to do that now. That resulted in Mr. Broyles' arrest. We were in the process at that time of dismissing him based on the outcome of our investigation, which was not for the purpose of suspected sexual abuse, but other policy infractions that we were moving to dismiss him from state service.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Mr. Jester, so the state police is telling us that January 03, they didn't have anything, and another victim came forward, and that's why the case was reopened. That was it was less than that time. It's less than a year.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, that is absolutely the case, as our chronology shows.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Jester, so have you been able to look at what they gave you in January 2003? Now, what did that investigation, did it go into details of what they did find, back to the photos on the wall and other things like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes, it did, and it was based on the information contained in that police report that the Youth Authority conducted its internal investigation and moved for dismissal of this worker from state service.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, one more.
Please continue.
Thank you. Mr. Jester, did that January 2003 report, do you know of it tied Mr. Lyman and Mr. Bowles together at that time?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we knew that there was a tie prior to that between these two individuals in that Mr. Broyles was a case manager for a number of youth who had been placed in the Lyman foster home, and in his professional capacity and as part of carrying out his responsibilities as a case manager, he would have had routine contact not only with the youth but with the foster provider.
Thank you.
Representative Anna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you enlighten us as to when you put when that contact or the similarities between the two, or you tied the two together? When in the chronological report did that revelation come about?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, are you referring to tying together the sexual abuse?
No, the relationship of Lyman and Boyles.
Again, Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that relationship began at the time that Mr. Broyles first placed a youth in the Lyman Foster Home. He would have then began having contact both for the purposes of supervision of the youth offender that was placed in that home as well as with the foster care provider. So that would have dated back to, I believe, the time of the certification of the home, which was 1994.
Please continue.
Seven, what course of action was taken when Mr. Boyle's supervisor told police detectives about, quote, his preference for clean-cut 13 to 17-year-old boys? The OIA was first made aware of this statement from the initial Oregon State Police investigation, which led to our internal investigation of Mr. Boyle's and his dismissal from state service.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnot and then Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Jester, that would be 2002.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, that would be the year 2003. January of 2003, we received the initial police report from OSP, which contained that statement.
Madam Chair.
Certainly.
But, Mr. Jester, you're saying first made aware of the statement from the initial. Okay. That was November is when they started the investigation.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
I think this is the part that troubles me the most. And if the supervisor talked to police about this matter, and knows, and I don't want to get the terminology and whether this is an exact quote from the police report or what, but if a supervisor had that type of concerns, why didn't the supervisor initiate action? And why? And if he didn't, why hasn't OIA went down? I guess I want to know who knew when, and then what have you done about it?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think that is the question before us as we review this matter. In specific response to the comment attributed to the supervisor in the January 03 Oregon State Police report, that supervisor left the employment of the Oregon Youth Authority in 1998. And the interview that was conducted by the Oregon State Police was conducted outside of his employment with us. He no longer worked for us.
Okay.
And hasn't since, I believe, 1997 and 1998.
Senator Devlin?
I have a difficult question to actually ask. Obviously, this case has been around quite a while. Many people may have known of it, but many of us became aware of it with the death of Mr. Muniz at the Oregon State Penitentiary. At what time did Mr. Muniz enter the Oregon State Penitentiary? And was he convicted as a juvenile or convicted as an adult? Or, I mean, or basically, was he prior to the age of 18 is what I'm asking, when he allegedly committed the crime that put him at OSP?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I could not answer that question for you. I don't know offhand.
With my limited memory of this, is he was a relatively young man, and if he had committed it, the offense prior to his 18th birthday, he would have originally potentially have been in your custody when he was incarcerated. And when he was incarcerated in a juvenile facility, he would normally probably, I hate to say it this way, but would receive a lot more scrutiny about his potential for inflicting personal harm that he would in an adult correctional facility. That's simply just a reality of the size of the facilities and the number of staff that are there. But I'm just trying to find out because part of this, I mean, obviously people are saying that Mr. Muniz was a victim also in this, and part of this is trying to see, or some belief by some, that his victimization may have led to his suicide, may have been contributing to his suicide. But I'm trying to see who had custody of him and when, and whether or not he was ever in the OYA's custody as an incarcerated individual, and how he ended up at OSP.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I cannot tell you because I don't have the information in front of me at which point he transferred from the Oregon Youth Authority closed custody system to the Department of Corrections prison system. I do know that he did spend time in a youth correctional facility. I do not know if it was an additional law violation when he, I am being told by Deputy Lemon, who knows these things, that he, in fact, it was an additional law violation that took him to the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Can we get the details of that?
You certainly may.
Okay. Madam Chair, I think even contributing to that, Senator Devlin, would be that the lawsuits had already been submitted by then, so, you know, the information was out there in the correction system, and it was abused, and he's put into the regular. I mean, it's
the agency will follow up on the question and the concern that is being raised by Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to be fair about this too, because it's been my experience, although it's decades old, that obviously a juvenile in a detention facility gets a great deal of attention relative to their potential for inflicting harm on themselves. When you get into an adult correctional facility that might characteristically have ratios in terms of staff present of 1 to 80 or 1 to 150 or 1 to 200, although there is still a responsibility, the ability to check routinely on people that are incarcerated is very limited. So,
did you wish to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I absolutely agree with you. It is my recollection from my conversations with Department of Corrections that Mr. Muniz was in segregation at the time that his suicide occurred.
Which he should have been under very close supervision if he was in segregation.
Please continue, Mr. Jester.
Question number 8, how could Director Brazeau from 2000 to 2004 allege not to know the details of this case until 2002, at which time foster parents brought issues of Mr. Boyle's inappropriate behavior to light? While I am not speaking for Ms. Brazeau, 2002 was the first time the director's office was aware of a complaint, at which time Mr. Boyle was placed on administrative leave, later to be removed from state service, and Oregon State Police conducted their investigation. Question 9, what is the procedure of transferring a youth from one facility to another over the objection of family? Specific transfer procedures within the Oregon Youth Authority vary depending on the placement of the youth at the time the transfer is being made, whether it's a closed custody facility or whether it's a community-based facility. A family objecting to any placement decision can at any time request a review before a court hearing, and oftentimes we will advise and work with family members and youth to do just that, to have the facts of their case reviewed before the committing court for a review by an independent member of the judiciary. There is also citizen review boards which are operated in each county under the judicial department that review out-of-home placements of youth that are in substitute care every 6 months. Youth Correctional Facilities OYA Administrative Review Board reviews all placements and transfers within the closed custody system. A transfer is dependent on youth treatment needs, risk need, and a match of those two to the available program. In residential program, OYA contracts for youth residential placements across the state. Referrals are made by the juvenile parole probation officer and at times are also made by the committing court or a recommendation by the court for a specific type and often a specific placement. Program staff reviews referrals, interviews youth, and determines whether the program can meet the youth's individual treatment needs and address community safety concerns. In foster care, juvenile parole and probation officers make direct referrals to foster homes. Families that object to placements or case planning in any of these circumstances may request a hearing before the court, and OYA routinely present case plans to judges regarding case planning and management. In both residential placements and foster care, cases are reviewed by the Citizens Review Board in each individual county jurisdiction. Citizen Review Boards are comprised of private citizens who are appointed by the juvenile court to provide independent oversight and review of cases of youth who are placed by this agency in substitute care. Youth and their families are invited to attend all Citizen Review Board hearings. The board presents their findings and recommendations directly to the committing court. Question 10, what is a guideline for the state supervised children spending extended periods of time with their probation officer, including overnight stays? Juvenile parole and probation officers for the Oregon Youth Authority follow guidelines that establish standards of supervision. The frequency of contacts with youth is based on their level of risk and their individual supervision needs. OYA has adopted a policy prohibiting personal relationships with youth outside of the staff's professional responsibilities. The policy is attached for your review. OYA prohibits youth staying overnight with OYA staff. 11. What is the procedure by the state when letters are received from family or perhaps an attorney representing the family of a youth in state custody when abuse is strongly suspected? As mandatory reporters of child abuse, OYA employees report suspected abuse to the Oregon State Police by phone, fax, or email, and attached is the ORS that we referred to in the overview. Question number 12, by what rule or statute can the family of a youth in state custody be denied any contact? OYA prohibits contact between youth and their families only in very limited circumstances, such as when the family is interfering with the youth's treatment or when contact is prohibited by court order. Oftentimes that will be the case where a family member is excluded from contact by court order because they are the perpetrator of abuse on that young person. Family members can request review of these decisions by OYA administrators in a court case review hearing or through the regular Citizen Review Board process. OYA encourages input by families and accepts recommendations for contact with youth and into the development and implementation of their case plans. We encourage families to have contact unless there are reasons for the safety of the youth or safety of the community that would be compromised by that contact. Agency administrative rules governing visitation in youth correctional facilities encourage family visitation as well, and we've attached that OAR for your review. Madam Chair, those are our responses to date and the information we have gathered to our ability to openly and transparently provide information to these 12 questions. Attached is the timeline of events, which I think is a short kind of one-page chronology beginning in January 21st, 1993, when Mr. Boyles was hired by the state of Oregon as a social service specialist by then Children's Services Division, and again concluding with the scheduled trial on June the 27th of 05. We have been requested by the Senate Judiciary Committee on March of 28 to make a presentation before that body as well, and I would imagine that they will have a separate and additional set of questions that they would like us to answer at that time.
And for your information, Mr. Jester, we will be sharing with the Judiciary Committee the information that you've provided in this hearing so that it can be a part of their record as well. What other investigations are underway
around these tragic events, investigations external to the Oregon Youth Authority.
Madam Chair, the Department of Justice is involved in putting together information in a case for the two notice of tort that have been filed against the state alleging abuse by Mr. Broyles. One of those is not Mr. Munoz, by the way. We have not had a tort notice filed by his family. We continue internally to review these matters and review them against our foster care policies and administrative rules. We continue to review them against our training for staff, both certifiers as well as our parole and probation staff, to always look that the eye of improving the services that we provide and ensuring that we are maintaining youth in the safest possible environment while addressing the safety concerns of the community. We have, as I previously mentioned, directed that all employees of the Oregon Youth Authority, from myself on down to our support staff, cooks, and those in other positions that are not directly tied to the supervision and the management of youth offenders, will receive mandatory abuse report training so it is absolutely clear what the statute requires. We will be going beyond that in discussion both with our parole probation staff and our facility staff and identifying, hopefully with the outcome of this review committee, if there are other areas that were absolutely clear that dots were not connected and if we need additional process or procedure with which to do that. We are discussing in agency the lack of a one-place reporting. There was a public safety ombudsperson. That position was abolished during one of the budget reductions. We will look to the outside review committee to make recommendation. If such a position existed, would that have made a difference in the end in the handling of this case, recognizing that that position did exist through most of the duration of the chronology of this case? We also are addressing, independent from waiting for outside review and recommendation, the potential, and I say potential because I don't believe that we know for certain, that there may be a culture in any of our offices or work locations where jokes or rumors could rise to the level of professional concern and are not dismissed as being something that isn't of the attention in a workplace. I'm sorry.
Did you want to continue your thought?
Just one additional thing that I believe that I had mentioned to you, Senator, previously, that in January of 2004, the Oregon Youth Authority hired an internal auditor, and the first part of the process of that internal auditor is to complete a comprehensive risk assessment of the agency and where our exposure to risk lies. And, of course, part of that risk is associated with the safety of youth and the safety of communities. And one of the top two areas that were identified was, in fact, foster care. And the first audit that the internal auditor has been working on is a statewide comprehensive review of our foster care system. That is due to come out in draft, almost coinciding with these hearings, and I would anticipate that we would have a final product before the end of April with a set of findings by the audit of foster care. I believe that that will lead the agency to further specific improvements that we will put into an implementation plan.
Senator Devlin, and then Representative Hanna, and then Representative Wisnott.
I had two questions, actually, that they are relative to this case, but not specific to this case. you learn something every day in one of these hearings. I did not realize that you actually had foster homes that were under your control. How many children do you have in foster homes, and how many foster homes are there? There's a follow-up to that.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, we have 103 family foster homes that the Oregon Youth Authority currently has certified, and we have an additional 104 Proctor homes, which are foster homes that are attached to private agencies in the community, for a total of 207 homes.
It's foster.
And we have 148 youth that are currently in family foster care.
In both the case of the Proctor and foster homes, you were indicating that, well, at least in the foster, you might want to know if both, they're inspected monthly, or at least they're visited monthly. Who visits? And basically, that's the follow-up.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the home is certified by an OYA foster home certifier. That certifier has a responsibility to make an on-site visit at that home once per month. In addition to that, the case manager of the youth offenders who are placed in that foster home have a separate and independent responsibility to see each of their youth a minimum of once per month face-to-face contact.
Another follow-up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
The certifier, is that in all cases an OYA employee?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the certifiers are OYA employees, yes.
Final question. I hate to ask this question because it's actually more directed at state's liability in these issues, but given the high profile of some of these cases and the tragedies that have occurred, when you are required to notify law enforcement, do agencies insist on some confirmation from law enforcement that they have received the notice?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, specific to the Youth Authority, we do not have the volume of referral to law enforcement as some other agencies may have in regards to protection of children. And those reports to Oregon State Police are routinely logged. For example, if there was to be an allegation in a facility that a youth may have been sexually abused by another youth, or there was unnecessary force applied to that youth by a staff person and that complaint is made, the referral to the Oregon State Police would be logged out from that facility as a complaint to Oregon State Police to investigate, and then subsequent follow-up information would be included in that. With the advent of the JGIS system, where there is now a central repository for information, both with case notes and case plans, and those are being routinely used by our case management staff to record and document activity with a case, that would be where these matters would be tracked back to.
Madam Chair, I very much appreciate that answer. And in your limited cases, and maybe others, that would be sufficient. The only thing I would be worried about is going beyond OIA, is when you get out into cases of other cases of abuse being reported, whether it's by some county mental health agency or whether it's by county juvenile justice agency to maybe not the state police but a local sheriff's office, that it would not be improving the system greatly if we find later that there is a problem, not only in cases being, which is somewhat the perception now, cases being reported to law enforcement, but once they get to law enforcement, being acted on.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I don't want in any way my testimony before this committee today to indicate that we have any reason to believe that the Oregon State Police did not follow up on every matter that has been referred to them. And when they do not follow up on a case involving an OYA youth, there is always discussion and a dialogue, and we know up front from the Oregon State Police the fact that they have reviewed it. These are the reasons they're not going to proceed or pursue it, and that information comes back to us. We have not experienced any problem in the Oregon State Police not providing follow-up of investigations.
Madam Chair, I would not want to in any way infer that the Oregon State Police would not follow up. I just have a general concern in this area, and when I saw the language in there in terms of I think, what is the term, decline to take any action? In my experiences, that would be a relatively normal in many cases, but it's kind of a way that it's stated, it's probably not understood. If they can find no evidence of a criminal law violation, or the inability to actually prove a violation, or that witnesses to the violation are inconsistent, many law enforcement agencies do decline to investigate further because they have to make a decision on whether or not there is sufficient evidence of the allegations to warrant further investigation. That's quite normal.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, you testified that the current OYA practices on scheduled and unscheduled visits to foster homes, that's a new process that came about after review of these cases that we're discussing. Would it be prudent or possible for you to provide for us maybe a listing of the changes that the OYA made based on the review of this case, and maybe put the timelines that those changes went into place? Because I would hope we'd find a long trail of learning out of the many things that we've seen here, but it would be interesting to see. Secondly, and I just don't understand, why do all these cases, the reported incidents, go through OSP and not whatever local law agency that the jurisdiction would be within?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, first again to draw your attention to the document, which is an overview of actions that the Youth Authority has taken to address staff conduct, staff management of youth, and foster home management. These are a partial list, I think, of what you're asking for. We will work on completing that, and we'll definitely put them in the form of a chronology and tie them back to events or information that we were trying to address and improve. And the response to your second question is that we have used state police as if they are a state agency, and they have investigated allegations of law violations involving youth in state custody or in programs that we contract for. And oftentimes the state police are working very collaboratively at the local level, but that gets to that point of kind of one-stop reporting. It is always to the state police, and that's who we keep our records in conjunction with.
Thank you.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of comments for you and the good of the committee, and then three short ones for Mr. Jester. I think you commented you're going to refer this or the information to the Judiciary Committee. I think Human Services also, because I'm not sure what CSD's role in for their actions. Their recent record is not very outstanding in the way they've handled some cases. Also, Madam Chair, I was on Judiciary in the interim and was made aware that 119B005 required members of the legislature to report suspected child abuse. One Friday afternoon, I got a call from a constituent saying that he wanted to report that his daughter, who was living with his ex, was being abused by her boyfriend. And I panicked. I didn't know what to do. I could see something over the weekend happening to this young girl. And so I called the Bend, Oregon, I called the child services Child Services Division, and they had no idea what I was doing or what do you mean you're reporting this. And I asked, and I had a really tough time trying to report it. The statute doesn't say how you report it, or what we talked about, getting a receipt or acknowledgement that you reported it, so I wouldn't have to worry that weekend that something terrible would happen to that poor girl. So I finally got them to give me an email, so I sent them an email saying that I had reported it in a timely manner. But so this statute does not cover that, and we need to, that's one of my lists to do, but that statute does not say how you report it or how you get acknowledgement that you've done your reporting in a timely manner. So, and then for the Mr. Jester, where's Mr. Lehman? Is he being investigated, or is he out there still in society? So, second question, when Mr. Bowles became part of OYA in 1996, did OYA review his background or do any further investigation on him? And my third question would be, is Mr. Bowles, did he retire? Does he have any earned benefits as an employee of the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, let me start with just to clarify, and I appreciate your comments regarding the Human Services Subcommittee. We are absolutely happy to testify before any committee about these matters and provide the same information and hopefully more information as we are able to get that processed. I do not want to leave this committee with the impression that we are either blaming or pointing the finger toward Children's Service Division for any of the decisions or matters in this case. The foster home was an OYA foster home at the time of the arrest, and we assume full responsibility for the decisions that we made regarding the supervision, the certification of this home. Mr. Lyman, when he left the foster care, he voluntarily gave up his certification. I can't tell you the date on that. He moved out of country, and at the time these events unfolded, he was not in Oregon, and a warrant was issued for his arrest. He was later extradited, returned to Oregon, and charged in Multnomah County. With the recent death of Mr. Munoz, some of those charges were dropped because there was not a witness to testify against him. My understanding is that there have been additional charges filed, and I believe that he is out on bail, although I could not swear to that. That's my understanding of his current status. Charges pending, out on bail.
Thank you. And Mr. Bowles, is he in jail now or on bail? And does he get retirement or any benefits he's earned from the state of
Oregon? Mr. Boyle's employment was terminated in March of 2004 by OYA. That termination, my understanding, does not have bearing on retirement accounts or anything.
It's not my question.
Like that. He is current.
Would you like to clarify?
My question is, did he earn or is he receiving retirement or any benefits in the state of Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I could not answer your question as to whether or not he is receiving retirement benefits from the state of Oregon. I know that he is currently residing in Multnomah County Jail, where he has resided since his arrest.
Well, Madam Chair, he can receive his benefits and be in jail, I understand.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I am certainly not disputing the fact that that can happen. I do not know, however, whether he is or not.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question related to the overview of agency actions. On your item 7, you're indicating under that first bullet that you're in the process of obtaining pre-employment screening tool to improve agency ability to ensure that prospective employees have appropriate personal characteristics for working with you. Is there currently not a pre-employment screening tool in practice?
Madam Chair, this has been an area that the Youth Authority has been interested in since its inception. There is not currently a pre-employment screening tool that would indicate propensity on the part of a potential hiree to have any kind of sexual dysfunction, interest in youth, etc. I attended a meeting of the National Corrections Association directors, which are my counterparts in the other 49 states. No state is currently using, although all states are interested in finding the same kind of a screening tool, and that would be to only enhance that which we already do, which is a fingerprint-based criminal history check nationally. We also do interviews. We also do scenario training at our training academy where all of our staff start out. And some of the responses to situations that the scenario training puts them in would lead us in a direction of either seeing this as a good hire or not during the trial service period, but that there is not, to our knowledge, in existence, an instrument that we could purchase and begin using right away. We have had an RFP out for such an instrument or for a university that may have interest in working with the Oregon Youth Authority in developing and piloting such an instrument. And we see this ultimately being very beneficial to the staff of the Youth Authority and to the youth that we serve. So we have a very high interest in getting there.
Okay, thank you. I have another question, but it's for Mr. Shepherd, Deputy Attorney General, are you able and willing to comment on the record? I asked a question earlier about external reviews, investigations that are going on. Can you comment on the record about the Attorney General's office role in this matter?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I can describe a little bit about what the department's role is. As Mr. Jester has indicated, we are performing the function that we do, defending the claims that have been filed against the state. Current status of the two civil claims that you've heard referred to earlier in the testimony is that they've been stayed or put in abeyance, deep freeze in effect, until after the criminal allegations are resolved against Mr. Boyles. The state's handling of any such claim includes, obviously, as detailed an inquiry as we can conduct to learn about what occurred so that we can evaluate and handle the claims that have been lodged against the state. So part of our handling of the investigation that DOJ is involved in has to do with exploring the facts and developing those facts so that we can best handle that response.
Any further questions or comments? Well, this has been an opportunity to try and discover what went wrong and why things went so horribly and tragically wrong, resulting in the death of the young man, Aaron, who knows. And so it's an opportunity to discover what we can learn from this tragic situation. What are the changes that will be necessary and that need to be corrected either by administrative rule, addressed in administrative rule, policy, practice, legislation. That will be the process of discovery. But the other thing that is absolutely required is that we demonstrate, and I'm using the collective we, certainly the agency, Oregon Youth Authority, but also the legislature, that we demonstrate to the public that we are doing everything within our power to be transparent and to demonstrate accountability for the events, the tragic events that have taken place. I do appreciate your responses to the questions, and that you will also be speaking before the Senate Judiciary Committee and Representative Wisnat. We will follow up with the Human Services Committee, as you are recommending that we do. If there are no further, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a very brief comment. I know this must be a very difficult time for the agency and for personally to be coming for an international list. This is one of the most, I've been involved in government at one level or another for almost 24 years. This is one of the most serious breaches of governmental ethics I think I've ever seen, in terms of the power that people in this position would have over a youth, which is even different than like a parole officer over an adult. The fact that the agency is there to protect children, and in this case, victimize them. I mean, this gets to the soul of the Youth Authority. If there were other employees that were aware and did nothing, that would be incredibly damaging. If there's action that should have been taken that wasn't, I'm not concerned about liability or whether a procedure was followed or not, but I'm very concerned that the culture of an organization could have allowed this to occur for that long. And that culture has got to change. And it's not a case of us being accountable to the public or whatever. It's a case of this culture absolutely has to change. And that may be difficult, but I don't know the steps that you take to make sure this happens, but it has to.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. I think we all identify with what you're saying. Thank you very much. Members, I'm going to ask that we take 3 minutes at ease while we make a transition. And again, Mr. Jester, Mr. Lemon, Deputy AG. Shepard, thank you very much. And Mr. Jester, before you begin again, let me, on behalf of the committee, thank you for coordinating our opportunity to visit McLaren and Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facilities one day last week. All the days are starting to blend. You'd have to tell me what day.
Thursday, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very enlightening. And again, we appreciate your efforts to help us with that, and all of the staff at McLaren and Hillcrest who made themselves available, as well as the young people who were kind enough to respond to our questions and inquiries about their lives. You would like to bring someone up to join you?
Slowly up here, Madam Chair, but I'm going to start the first part myself.
Okay. All right. Where would you like to go? We have our notebooks in front of us, and if you want to just tell us how and where to follow along, we'll do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I would like to thank all of you who
participated in the tours last week at McLaren Hillcrest, and for those of you I know that at the last minute got pulled away, if there is interest in visiting either of those facilities, give us a holler and we'll set those up for you around your schedules. It is incredibly meaningful for the youth that are at McLaren Hillcrest, along with our other facilities and programs in the community, to have members of legislature visit and take an interest in what and how they are doing. So on behalf of the youth that were able to participate with you, I thank you for them as well. I'm going to be working, we are going to be working for the next 3 days from the book that I believe your copy has a yellow triangle on the front, which is the Governor's Budget Ways and Means presentation document. And on the table of contents, I will do the agency overview, and I am going to call a couple people up individually to participate in parts of that. We will then address the facility services, which would be the facilities that OIA operates. We will then do capital budgets, and then our community and program services. We will then do administration, and then we will do the performance measures. So I will start on page one, which is the mission statement of the Oregon Youth Authority, which is to protect the public by holding youth offenders accountable and providing opportunities for reformation. And to achieve this, we emphasize public safety, provide certain consistent sanctions for youth offenders through a continuum of services. We support the concerns of crime victims, provide comprehensive youth reformation programs, and promote and support juvenile crime prevention activities. Down at the bottom of the page, list of agency goals, enhance the appropriate continuum of services across the juvenile justice system. With the budget reductions that all state agencies have had to face, it has been a time that juvenile justice agencies, both at the state and county and private level, have come together and have said, this is what we need to do to further strengthen this continuum with the resources that are available to us. We need to develop more effective and efficient ways to serve special population to gain the best possible outcomes with these youth. We need to provide for safer environments for youth, staff, and the public. I think we have spent some time today talking about that one in particular. We need to gain compliance with Senate Bill 267, which is the evidence-based bill. We have instituted 3 steps toward that: risk need assessments, case planning, and treatment protocols. To promote and contribute to state and local efforts to maximize outcome from prevention activities. This is one that I feel particularly strongly about. I think that we always need to balance the investment at this end of the system with the prevention end of the system so that we are able to continue those two efforts. Demonstrate leadership by ensuring staff are culturally competent and skilled in providing services that meet the diverse need of OIA youth. To develop and maintain the state's juvenile justice information system. To support OIA and county juvenile department operations and to manage report information. This, as we will talk more in the presentation, this is a major cornerstone of the efforts resulting from Senate Bill 1, is the integrated information system, which ties both counties and state together. There are essentially 37 users of this system, one of those being Oregon Youth Authority, the other 36 being local county juvenile justice systems. And this is the information system that provides us the kind of data that will have rapid turnaround in some of the questions you ask and the information that you see in this document during both Phase 1 and Phase 2 are a result in the state's investment in the juvenile justice information system. Now turning to page 2, a historical perspective, and I would like to read a quote from the final report of the Juvenile Justice Governor's Task Force from 1995, and it's the top of the page, and I think it really puts the framework on the purpose and the mission and the vision of the Oregon Youth Authority. And I quote, "Right now, there are no consequences for unlawful actions. There is no certainty of punishment. There is no accountability. The result? An escalation of offenses until the conduct is so outrageous that the system is forced to respond." And this comes from a 1995 report that was a year in the making, involving literally hundreds of people that contributed to that effort and resulted in the passage of Senate Bill 1 and the creation of the Oregon Youth Authority. The vision of the creation of the Oregon Youth Authority was in fact to put in place a continuum of services and sanctions and to provide adequate capacity to respond to those young people who needed services which were either not available in communities or not available at the state level. And the chart that you have before you kind of walks down, if you look at the top part, pre-1995 in Senate Bill 1, we had a total of 513 beds that the state operated for youth that were committed to then Children's Service Division for placement in a youth correctional facility. And on the community program side, we shared with the state Children's Services Division resources for those youth that left facilities and returned to the communities. In 1995-1996, Senate Bill 1 was passed by the state legislature, and again, the vision of creating this continuum of services available for youth both in communities and those that are committed to the state for care created a total of 1,150 beds. Now, this was 1,150, which included the 513. And there was a commitment and direction to strengthen community programs as well as a new $20 million basic crime prevention grant that flowed to local communities to provide the opportunity to further enhance those services at the front end of placement in state custody for youth that without those services would then rise into Oregon Youth Authority care and custody. You then look at the next box, which is the post-2001 cuts resulted from the four special sessions. We reduced from the 1,150 down to 1,066 beds. But important in the community side, we eliminated the shelter services and a 2% reduction in the programs and services that were available for young people in the community. The 03-05 session, this is when the failure of Measure 30 and the Oregon Youth Authority took significant reductions, which resulted in the closure of four of the five newly constructed regional facilities to address the influx of youth offenders committed both to OYA and those committed to the Department of Corrections and transferred to OYA for placement based on their age. This reduced our total bed capacity to 850, and we continued 82% of that which was in the community in regards to both residential foster and capacity for supervision and case management. So this just charts the pre-1995 where we were, that top quote, the vision of Senate Bill 1 and the creation of OYA, those resources being put online, and then as we went into the recession, the resources reduced.
Mr. Jester, a part of the vision was never funded, as is also captured on your chart. Would you please talk about the regional residential academies that don't exist, and if they were in place, what would that total bed capacity look like? What has it meant to the agency not to have that part of your service
components available.
Madam Chair, thank you for pointing that out in my attempt to hurry here to make up some time. I overlooked the regional residential academies, and this was a very important piece of the work that Task Force on Juvenile Justice Reform did. And the vision was, prior to commitment to a youth correctional facility, there was a need for a kind of resource that did not otherwise exist in the state of Oregon. And the vision was, it could either be a private or it could be operated by the state. And in I guess the best analogy would be almost like a boarding school, where young people who were experiencing difficulties in their communities, either through beginning to commit law violations and failure to appropriately engage in school, beginning to fall between the cracks, beyond parental control, those sorts of indicators that, if not provided some services and some supervision and some structure, it would be predictable that these youth would penetrate further in the juvenile justice system, either at the county or eventually into the state custody level. These regional residential academies were envisioned to be regional. We had established 5 regions across the state. There was a discussion around these being between 25 and 50 beds each, and would have the ability for youth to go into those programs and get the kind of structure and the kind of attention and services that they needed to be able to then return to their homes and their home communities and not require further penetration in the justice system to get those kinds of services. And they were not funded.
So in effect, we never funded the first step in the graduated sanctions, the first step being the one that could lead to prevention from further penetrating the system.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right in that statement.
Representative Woodnett.
Thank you, and I apologize, Mr. Jester, that maybe this came up in the tour, but the facilities we closed, are they in caretaker status? Are they available for use? And is Eastern, is that Burns? What is in it? Because the last one you have Eastern Oregon, but then it's Eastern.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the Oregon Youth Authority was funded to construct 400 state capacity beds during the implementation of Senate Bill 1, and this was to meet in part the influx of offenders that were falling into the net of Measure 11 and determinate sentencing. And those were sited in Warrenton, which is the North Coast facility, in Albany, which is the Oak Creek facility, in Grants Pass, which is Rogue Valley, Burns, which is the Eastern facility, and in Prineville, which is the Ochoco facility. Those were the 5 facilities that were constructed. North Coast reopened during the last biennium with a 25-bed capacity, and there are 50 vacant state beds in that facility. The Oak...
That place, sir.
The North Coast facility has 50 unfunded state beds. We are operating 25 beds there at the current time. Capacity 75. We are operating 25. There are 50 that are not funded. The Oak Creek facility in Albany has 75 state bed capacity and a county-operated detention facility. The county-operated detention facility is operating the 75 state beds in Albany at Oak Creek are not funded. The Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility in Grants Pass has 100 state beds. All of those beds are funded and have been since its opening. The Eastern facility in Burns has a 50-bed state capacity and a 10-bed county detention capacity. The 10-bed county detention capacity has never been funded by counties and therefore has never been used. And we are currently using 25 of the 50 beds there, so 25 are unfunded. The Ochoco facility in Prineville was transferred as a available surplus property to the Oregon National Guard and is currently either being used or will be used as a National Guard armory.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
I think you're bad.
If you look on page 3, I thought it important, there's a lot of questions that come up regarding how youth get to various parts of the system and exactly what the flow of the system is. And we actually have a flip chart here by Silton on the record and show you that flow. There are two tracks that
can
come into the system.
Mr. Jester, hold on just a moment. Can you hear his voice? Okay. All right.
Am I good? Let me know if I...
If you could move that microphone even closer to you, that would be great. Okay. Thank you.
Starting with a referral at the juvenile apartment level, and these referrals come in from law enforcement, from schools, from parents, from other community agencies. And from there, the county juvenile department does intake. And from intake, there is a couple of routes the case can be referred. One is for formal diversion and formal accountability agreements. And if those are successful, the case is done. It ends there. They can also go to a formal petition to the juvenile court. And the juvenile court can then do one of two things. They can adjudicate that offense, or, depending on the age of the offender and the nature of the offense, they can waive that young person to adult court. This is separate from Measure 11, but is a waiver. Starts at the juvenile court level. So following the adjudication as a delinquent youth, they can go one of two routes. They can go to county probation, where if successful, the case terminates. They can also go to OYA commitment. If they go to OYA commitment, they can go one of two routes. They can go to probation, which would be our front-end community case management, which includes foster care and residential treatment. If the youth offender was successful in completing the court-ordered and required elements of their individual case plan, it would be closed as a successful case. If that youth on probation were unsuccessful, they could go to the close custody system and find themselves in a youth correctional facility. The court, upon adjudication, if not probation, can commit to the OIA close custody facilities. From the facility, the youth can go out on parole, foster care, residential treatment, independent living, or home, which would be under the case management of our juvenile parole and probation staff. There is another series which starts in adult court, and this would be arrest and referral on a Measure 11 offense. And if the youth is charged with a Measure 11 offense, district attorney in adult court waived ends up in this box. If guilty, and the offense were committed prior to the age of 18 and sentenced before the age of 20, the offender, although in DOC's legal custody, would go into the physical custody of an OIA close custody program
and upon completion of that program would then go into either community correction supervision back in their home community, or they could go directly from our facility into a DOC facility. So this was designed to kind of show three tracks that cases take, all from kind of the central point of referral, green being the county track, blue being the OYA, you know, probation and facility track, and the red being the DOC adult corrections and into an OYA facility track.
Madam Chair.
Representative, what's that?
Mr. Jesser, where's the J-Bar-J? Are they the closed custody, or is that...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, they would be a residential treatment, community-based program that could be accessed either by youth leaving close custody or could be used for a probation youth that was placed in residential treatment. So they would have a combination of youth leaving close custody facilities as well as youth who were placed on probation.
We have about 3.5 minutes remaining, just to give you a time check.
I think the other point to be made on page 3 would be that of the offenders that are being managed in this system, this top green box where you have the juvenile department intake and juvenile department supervision, that represents about 16,500 youth. 16,500 youth are managed by counties at the local level. The youth authority is currently managing 2,027 cases, which includes those who are transferred from DOC for placement in the youth correctional facilities, which is about 315, 320 youth. Madam Chair, it's probably a good place for me to stop and resume on page 4, which is the case management and our OYA services and interventions, if that...
That seems like a good idea. Any further comments or questions, anything for the good of the order? Well, Mr. Jester, I want to say again, thank you. Appreciate your efforts and all of those who work with you, some of whom are behind you, literally, this afternoon. All of your hard work in getting prepared for these days. We'll look forward to seeing you back tomorrow. And we'll pick up on page 4. And as we pick up tomorrow and reflect back on the this chart that you're showing us, the Oregon Juvenile Justice System, I know you're going to be talking about the forecast, but at some point would like to hear your comments on the differences in forecasting in the adult system versus the juvenile system. On the adult side, there's a mandate to fund the forecast, but on the juvenile side, we don't have such a mandate. And what are the pressures and challenges around that reality? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, we are adjourned.